You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a new UW study could pave the way for humans finally to hibernate. Well, maybe not exactly like other animals do it, but there's hope. We'll talk to one of the study's authors. First, Wall Street investors are interested in buying the Menominee Falls-based Kohl's retail chain. That says Kohl's has been under pressure from some activist investors who say the company is underperforming. Last week, Kohl's officially rejected at least one bid to buy the company, but they say they're entertaining interest from others. Depending on the outcome, it could mean big changes for the Wisconsin company. Rich Kirchen joins us now. He's a senior reporter for the Milwaukee Business Journal who's been following the story. Rich, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Well, let's look at interest from the outside and pressure from the inside. First of all, who is sniffing around looking to maybe buy Kohl's?
Well, there's one offer that was confirmed, and it's from a New York hedge fund called Starboard that was partnering with a publicly traded company called Acacia Research. They did confirm that they made an offer for $64 a share. There also were reports in the national business media that Sycamore Partners, which is a private equity firm from New York, had offered about $65 a share. There's been speculation that Amazon might be interested, but they have not commented.
And there's been some pressure, I understand, from your reporting, I think, Rich, that some shareholders, current shareholders, are putting pressure on the company to make the sale?
That's true. Most notably, McKellum, which is an investment firm also from the East Coast. Their CEO has been very outspoken. They own about 5% of Kohl's stock, and they actually have been putting pressure on the company since last year. They had reached an agreement with Kohl's last April that allowed McKellum to and some other investors to appoint two members to the Kohl's board. But they're not happy with the company's progress so far. They say sales have not bounced back enough from the worst year of the pandemic in 2020 in terms of sales. And they're saying that the stock price has underperformed for about 20 years, and they think a new management team is needed, and perhaps a new owner should make those changes.
Yeah, this has been a tough time for a lot of big retailers. Some of them no longer exist. A lot of them have closed stores. Relative to that, how is Kohl's doing?
Well, they're relatively healthy. You know, a lot of other retailers have gone out of business in Wisconsin, most notably Shopko and Bon-Ton, which owned Boston Store and Yonkers. So, it's a tough business these days, especially because of Amazon. Kohl's is relatively healthy. Their cash flow is about $1 billion a year, which is considered pretty strong considering the size of the company. So that being said, though, they've been trying all kinds of strategies to keep people coming in the doors.
Talking to Rich Kirchen from the Milwaukee Business Journal, looking at Kohl's, the retail chain based here in Wisconsin, offers to buy it. Rich, you mentioned hedge fund companies, private equity companies maybe looking to buy Kohl's. That doesn't always end up being happy times for people who work at a company when they're bought by those kind of companies. What are thoughts on what could happen if they are the ultimate purchaser?
Yes, you're right. Both of those categories of what they're called financial buyers, and they are looking to make a profit over not too long of a time horizon, could be 2, 3, 5 years at the most. So they typically come in, try to cut some costs and increase the cash flow and profits and try to sell the company at a profit. So the concern would be that they would, either trim or slash employees at the headquarters in Menominee Falls, perhaps at other levels. There's been talk about spinning off the e-commerce business, Kohl's.com, and selling off and then leasing back the real estate as a way of getting some cash. So all those things could happen, and it can cause, certainly not necessarily good news for the hometown here in suburban Milwaukee.
And Rich, you wrote about the idea that Amazon might be interested. As you said, Amazon's not saying if they're interested. Why would it make sense for this online giant to want this brick and mortar chain?
Well, there are a couple of reasons, and I think the main reason that the connection is being made is that Kohl's and Amazon have been partnering together on a couple different things in recent years under Michelle Gass, who is the Kohl's CEO and is looking to diversify revenue streams, bring people into the stores. And they have a program where people who get shipments from Amazon and decide they want to send merchandise back can do it at a Kohl's store. So there's already a relationship, and it's been going on for 2 or 3 years. And Amazon has shown an interest in bricks and mortar. They bought Whole Foods a few years ago and still own it. And Amazon has opened small numbers of its own bricks and mortar stores as it sort of tests the water. So it seems like they do have some interest in spite of the fact that they're doing perfectly well as the online giant of the world. But, Kohl's has nearly 1,200 stores, and that could have some appeal. But again, Amazon has said that they're not commenting. They don't comment on speculation and rumors.
And Rich, you mentioned employees of Kohl's, obviously watching this closely. Want to talk about the role of Kohl's for a lot of communities around the state. Stores from, you mentioned Shopko back to Prangy Way are gone. Sears and JCPenney's have closed a lot of their stores over the years. Is Kohl's kind of a last holdout for a department store for a lot of communities?
Well, they are. You know, I'm thinking of my family owned a place up a lake home up near Rhinelander for a lot of years, and Kohl's moved in up there. There's a Walmart there also in Rhinelander, but there are certainly a lot of towns around the state. You know, you think of some of the smaller towns that had a Yonkers store, mm-hmm. and when Bon-Ton went through bankruptcy, they lost those. So, yeah, there's no doubt that besides Walmart and maybe a couple of other stores. And of course, Kohl's has that emphasis on apparel and maybe a bit higher price point than a Walmart. So it definitely can be a lifeline for a lot of shoppers in the smaller communities.
Rich, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
You are welcome.
That's Rich Kirchen, senior reporter for the Milwaukee Business Journal, with us today to talk about what a possible change in Kohl's ownership could mean for the Wisconsin company, its employees, and its customers. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about one boy's surprise visit from a local Olympic gold medalist.
There's something kind of magical about watching the Olympics. The competition, the diversity, the sportsmanship, and camaraderie. 4 years ago, a boy from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, fell in love with curling. And recently, a knock on his door has him even more excited for the games in Beijing.
I'm Eric Ernst.
And I am Jackson Ernst.
Jackson was 5 years old when he discovered curling during the 2018 Winter Olympics.
Well, when I was younger, we were watching the Olympics, and the only thing that I didn't want to turn on any other Olympic theme rather than curling. And I kept watching it, and I kept replaying it over and over and over again.
Yeah, Jackson's been a hockey player since he was very little, but he was really intrigued by another sport on the ice like that.
McFarland, Wisconsin's Matt Hamilton won a gold medal in curling that year as part of Team USA in the men's competition.
Well, I'm Matt Hamilton, second for Team Schuster and 2022 Olympian.
So recently when Matt...
Here, hold on, I got one more shot to throw.
Yeah, so I caught up with Matt at curling practice recently.
All right. What's going on?
All right, so Matt saw a social media post from Jackson's dad about his son's curling obsession back during the 2018 Olympics.
After watching us win, that they went to like Kohl's or something, and he used like whatever money he got for Christmas or something, or his birthday or something, to buy like a cleaning set so he could get a broom. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, that's amazing. Any broom will do, apparently.
Yeah, I used a ball, and I basically just rolled it, and then I got my broom, and I kind of just sweeped.
And he did. He spent the rest of the Olympics every time curling was on, just, sweeping around the house.
So when Hamilton saw Jackson's story on Twitter...
Matt shared it with his followers, and then he sent us a message and said, can you share your address? I'd love to send Jackson a gift. And so I did, and I didn't think anything of it.
And then I found out he's just in Sun Prairie. So I was like, I've got the time. Like, I'll just put on a KN95 mask, and I'll go visit him and drop him off.
I had to do a double take because there's Matt Hamilton standing on our front porch. And so I quick raced to the door, and I said, Matt, oh my gosh.
And he was like, hey, Jackson's actually out back playing hockey right now.
And he said, he has a rink in the backyard. And so he was super excited about that.
It's like, perfect. I'm pretty comfortable on an ice rink, so let's go.
Yeah, Jackson has his own ice rink in the backyard.
So how that started is my dad had kind of like hockey friends, and like they were all saying how they built ice rinks. And he was like, okay, I'll give it a whirl.
I wish I had something like that as a kid. I grew up on a hill, so I had a prime sledding location. All the kids came to my house to go sledding, but never had a hockey rink.
So what did Jackson think about gold medalist Matt Hamilton standing right there in front of him?
I was like, okay, so Matt Hamilton comes to our house, he says hi, and then just leaves. And then I'm so shocked because I look in the bag and there's all the stuff that he used for the trials.
The gift bag included an autographed hat.
One of my old Team Schuster hats that I literally washed all the sweat stains off of to give to him. It was literally game used, probably an entire season worn.
And he brought his official curling glove that he signed that he used in the trials also. And he got a pin.
And a bag tag.
Yeah, a bag tag. On the front it says USA, but on the back it says... Oh, Matt Hamilton.
He was really excited and, pumped to show me some hockey moves that he was doing, so it was fun.
I can teach him how to be a hockey player, and he can teach me how to play curling.
As Hamilton heads to another Olympics, Jackson will be rooting for his new friend, Matt.
Just being, like, a good role model for kids like Jackson and a good representative for Wisconsin is super important for me.
Thanks to Jackson, his dad, Eric, and thanks to Olympic gold medalist Matt Hamilton.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, we learn about a new study from UW-Madison researchers looking at how ground squirrels, some varieties of them, hibernate, and find out why that research could end up helping people with degenerative disorders. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Squirrels may be common, may be annoying if you have a bird feeder, but there are still some lessons we can learn from them, planning ahead, for one. But a new study from UW-Madison says there's more we can learn from a particular species of squirrel that hibernates. The question, how can they rest for such a long time and not lose significant muscle mass? The answer lies in the squirrel's gut. Hannah Carey is a professor emeritus in the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She's the co-author of a study just published last month in the journal Science. Hannah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob.
Well, what got you interested in investigating hibernating animals in the first place?
Well, my laboratory focuses on what happens to the gastrointestinal tract, the gut, during hibernation when no food is taken in for many months each year, up to 6 months while they're hibernating. That effect on the gut, as well as other tissues like skeletal muscle and the liver, would lead to atrophy, loss of mass, and changes in function because no new food is taken in. But it turns out that the gut enhances its protective mechanisms and is able to continue doing what it does to keep the microbes that live in the gut where they should be and not get into the body. And hibernators are known to recycle some of their own body proteins internally to help make new amino acids to supplement their protein stores, like to maintain muscle mass. What we did was bring in the world of the microbiome and followed up on earlier suggestions that maybe the symbiosis between gut microbes and the hibernator could further recycle a waste product, urea, to provide new nitrogen needed for protein building, and therefore help maintain muscle mass until they emerge in the spring.
I want to talk about the particular squirrels here. Now, a lot of our squirrels here in Wisconsin don't hibernate. We see them in action all winter. But these guys are the 13-lined ground squirrels. Can you tell us a little bit about them and their hibernation habits?
Sure. There's actually two branches, if you will, of the squirrel family, a large family of rodents. The tree squirrels that, of course, live in trees and stay active all winter long, living off of their stored food, nuts and things. The ground squirrels is another group of rodents that includes ground squirrels, marmots, prairie dogs, and even chipmunks. They're all relatives. And all of those live in burrows underground. And most species of ground squirrels and these other relatives have the ability to change their metabolism drastically after storing a lot of fat during the summertime. They lower their metabolism, go underground, and stay there for the rest of the winter. So the 13-lined ground squirrel is a great Midwestern hibernator of this group. Another one that probably does what we're talking about with our squirrels is the groundhog, otherwise known as the woodchuck. These are two cousins of this ground squirrel family.
So now the mystery you solved here is how can they do that without their muscles degenerating? And you mentioned it's the gut biome. It's a recycling the key substances here. Do we know which microorganisms in their guts are actually doing this stuff?
Yes, we do. These are organisms and microorganisms, and not all of them do this, but they make and produce an enzyme called urease, and its job is to split the molecule known as urea, which we usually excrete in the urine from our bodies. We, meaning all of us mammals, humans and animals and even other vertebrate animals that aren't mammals. And some of this urea, instead of being excreted, goes into the gut, where only those specific microbes that make urease are able to split that molecule, producing the nitrogen, liberating it, if you will, and then that nitrogen gets absorbed back into the animal's body, goes to the liver, and is used to make new amino acids that then go on and make new protein.
Now, this is cool to understand this mystery in and of itself, but I understand there's a hope that there might be applications for us humans, especially for people with certain degenerative conditions. What might the hope be here?
Yes, the hope is that by further understanding the various steps of this urea nitrogen recycling mechanism, we can eventually come up with a therapeutic approach, perhaps, to enhance the ability of the gut microbes in an animal or a human with one of these types of muscle wasting diseases, and harness the power of the microbes to help their animal or human host build back their protein again. In our study, we studied several steps that involve both the animal and the microbe side that makes this symbiosis happen. And on both ends of the spectrum, there may be ways to promote this for individuals that really could use that extra help, basically recycle their own waste product known as urea.
And I saw, I think it was one of your co-authors quoted saying, hey, maybe if we're ever interested in long-term space travel for humans, this might hold the key to helping us, you know, not die during it.
Yes, there are a number of dangers, of course, with deep space travel. Just storing enough food on board is one of them, but there is potential of radiation damage to the body systems and other things. And hibernation in general holds some clues, including resistance to radiation damage, that may help when in the future. Again, with more research on the basics of how the hibernators do what they do so well, we may be able to apply this to enhance the nutritional regime for astronauts, reduce skeletal muscle mass loss, resist radiation damage. But again, this is far in the future at this point. The clues are there that we want to follow up, and we and others want to follow up.
And speaking of going boldly forth to discover new places, it seems like whether we're talking about humans or ground squirrels, there are a lot of mysteries still in our guts, in the biomes of our digestive systems. How much more is there we need to understand about these things?
Oh, there's a lot more. We're at the beginnings of understanding how the symbiosis between an animal or a human and its gut microbes benefits health and contributes to who we are today. All animals, including humans, evolved in a world surrounded by bacteria, but various microorganisms since the very early days. So it's not surprising that they've played a role in the evolution of our physiology and our anatomy. The more we understand how we work together with those microbiomes in our guts and other surfaces of our bodies, the better we can think about how they contribute to our health.
Hannah, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Hannah Carey is Professor Emeritus at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We talked to her today about a new study she co-authored looking at how a species of ground squirrels who hibernate are able to use their own gut microbes to sustain themselves while hibernating, and how this process could potentially help humans in a couple different ways in the future. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there are a lot of great reasons to go for a walk for our mental, emotional, and physical well-being, among other things. But do we have good walkable communities here in the state? We'll hear the case for walking from the author of a new book, and then we'll take a tour of some of the state's most walkable places, big and small. One of our guests did kind of a survey of small communities, especially in the state, found a lot of great places to go walking. You can let us know about your community right now. Get us started. Email ideas at WPR.org. Do you think it's set up well to go for a walk? Email ideas at WPR.org. Oh, and hey, we want to hear from you about this one too. How does music fit into your life? We want to hear from you about your listening habits and what your favorite music means to you and your daily routine. Again, fire up that email, ideas at WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a federal commission is out with its ideas for how to cut down on dangerous synthetic drugs like fentanyl. We'll take a closer look at how fentanyl trafficking works and what can be done about it on the supply and demand side. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at a bill that just passed the U.S. House that lawmakers say will save the U.S. Postal Service $50 billion in the next 10 years. First, more than 100,000 Americans died from drug overdoses over a one-year period starting in May of 2020. That's up 30% over the previous year. The recent rise of fentanyl is a big part of the story. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that's mixed into other drugs, making them more potent and deadly. Yesterday, the Bipartisan Federal Commission on Combating Synthetic Opioid Trafficking put out a report with dozens of recommendations on how to deal with the problem. On the list of suggestions, more coordination of law enforcement and diplomatic efforts to curb the flow of fentanyl between countries. The commission also said reducing demand for drugs in the U.S. was a part of the answer and called for more investment and research into addiction treatment. We're talking now with a journalist who's been following this issue for years about the new challenges created by synthetic drugs, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has drug use or drug overdose affected you or your loved ones? Do you worry about the danger posed by drugs containing fentanyl? What do you think can be done about it? If you work in addiction treatment or in law enforcement, have you seen things change in recent years? Call in with your questions, your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sam Quinones is a journalist and author who's covered the drug trade for years. His books include Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and his latest, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here with you, Rob. Thanks very much.
We hear a lot about the dangers of fentanyl. Can you remind us what fentanyl is and why it is so hazardous?
Well, actually, fentanyl is a magnificent drug when used medically. Mm-hmm. It has revolutionized surgery. It has made surgery possible, but before it was not, or much more difficult, would have been much more difficult. It's a synthetic opioid invented in 1960. And one of the reasons, there's a couple of reasons why it became such a good anesthetic and did so much had so much benefit in the surgical context. One of them is it's extraordinarily potent, but it's short lasting. It comes in and out very very quickly. And so I've had fentanyl myself when I had a cardiac surgery after a heart attack. I'm very happy that I did, because you come out very quickly and you're not doped up for, you know, hours and hours after its use. You can be actually almost coherent. I was when they were putting a stent in me. And so the problem is that when this drug, which is an extraordinarily potent opioid, is then in the hands of people who don't have a clue how to use it or only are interested in the profit, because it's also an opioid. So it has the same addictive potential, actually even more enhanced addictive potential as heroin. It hits the same parts of our brain, the reward system in our brain as heroin does, and it creates massive withdrawals just the way heroin does. And so it's a drug that's been widely used in medicine, and in the last few years become widely used primarily because of its down in Mexico, they have learned how to make it, and they have access to the world chemical markets through several ports, and that allows them to make fentanyl in quantities that are simply staggering and have really covered the country with it.
And you've looked at the changing supply chain. We use this phrase supply chain for legal products. It has changed a lot for the production of fentanyl, from being produced entirely in China to, as you say, precursor chemicals. Can you talk about the changing flow of these products?
Sure. At first, the place where it was really coming from was China, in fact. The chemical companies, thousands of chemical companies over there, they began selling it on the dark web or also sometimes on the open internet. Some of the clients for that fentanyl were the traffickers in Mexico. In my book, The Least of Us, I tell the story of how the Mexican trafficking world discovered fentanyl through an underground chemist who later was then arrested, and they didn't really have access to him. So several years passed, but they never forgot that there was this synthetic heroin that could be produced in a lab instead of growing poppies. The Chinese began to produce it, but then in a few years ago, the Chinese government put a regulation on the number of companies that could actually produce fentanyl, and that meant that they did not control the ingredients that go into how you make fentanyl, and those companies that were selling fentanyl are now making the ingredients, selling that, and now what's happened in Mexico is the trafficking world down there has really learned how to make fentanyl and probably a few other chemical cousins, analogs of fentanyl as well, and they're getting those ingredients now from the Chinese chemical companies that many of which I believe once made fentanyl itself.
Talking to Sam Quiñones, author of books including The Least of Us, True Tales of America, and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, looking at the hazards of the drug fentanyl when used and produced illegally. You can join in with your thoughts, your stories at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chandra is with us in Ironwood, Michigan. Chandra, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
You know, I'm a recovering addict. I was prescribed OxyContin at a real young age, precursors to addiction, became addicted for about 16 years plus, really struggled with finding resources for addiction and also struggling with chronic pain. I have chronic pain from a birth defect in the spine. And so once that was taken away from me, I needed alternative solutions, but I also needed solutions for recovery so that I didn't fall back into synthetic opioids or prescription medication abuse. One of the things that I found that has been profound for me has been kratom. It's a plant from Southeast Asia. It's an evergreen. The leaves itself are ground up into a powder, and it interacts with opioid receptors in a much safer manner and also has an activity seal. So, therefore, you don't get suppressed breathing or heart rate to the point where overdose is imminent. So my two cents is, you know, looking into these botanical drugs, regulating them more appropriately, and creating safe access points where people have alternatives to, opioid treatment that may not necessarily be synthetic opioids.
Chandra, thanks a lot for the call. I know kratom is controversial to say the least, Sam, but on the treatment side of things, that's part of this report we're talking about. Do you have thoughts on kratom, first of all, and then on wider issues of helping people like Chandra, and glad you're in recovery, Chandra, stay in recovery?
Yes, I mean, I think we do need to think of a variety of things that were kind of sidelined when we had this very laser focus on using opioid painkillers as the solution to pain. I think in the pain management world, the idea had been and now is returning to credence that we need to have a variety of treatment options for chronic pain. The problem was really we tried to do cure all pain with one kind of pill for all kinds of human beings, and that just didn't work really. And so the idea being that now I think that, as I said, was very popular during the 70s and 80s and just got aced out by the opioid issue, is that we now need a wide variety of reimbursable treatment solutions that doctors can then meet and act as kind of a teammate with the patient on and adjust according to that individual's need. And that is what we've really been lacking, I think, when we're getting off the topic of synthetic drugs, I think, but that's really what's been lacking, I think, generally speaking, across the country when it comes to just managing chronic pain. It's the idea that all human beings are different and they need a wide variety of options to deal with each individual case of pain.
Chandra, thanks again for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. That's a little bit about the treatment and the demand side, Sam. Let's get into recommendations from this report on enforcement to try to stop the flow of these synthetic drugs into the U.S., diplomatic efforts. It seems like there's a lot of whack-a-mole. Once you fix things in one spot, the supply chain changes, the route changes.
Well, yes, but I mean, The big issue we're dealing with is the problem of Mexico. Mexico has a criminal justice system that on a good day is mediocre. I would say I lived down there for 10 years. I wrote two books about Mexico. And you get this feeling that really nothing's being done. Actually, I would say that there's more likelihood of a significant impact now, because unlike the days when they were making mostly plant-based drugs, marijuana, poppies, which you can grow all over Mexico. Mexico's a vast country with very mountainous areas. The crux here is that these traffickers now need chemicals coming from the entire world chemical market through a few ports. Those ports are their bottlenecks. If we actually put significant resources combined as binational effort, into controlling, examining, understanding the flow of those chemicals and blocking the chemicals that did not have a real good reason for being there, and controlling those chemicals into the port, you would immediately see a significant drop off. Would that production go somewhere else to another country? Maybe. But the reason we have so much methamphetamine and fentanyl, both synthetic drugs, all over the country, covering the country at prices that are historically low, is because in Mexico, they have this amazing capacity to get the chemicals, make the drugs, and then smuggle it across the 2,000-mile border with which we with the United States, where there's also a free trade agreement. So it might push it elsewhere, but I think that the quantities that we were seeing today, which are just staggering coast to coast, would significantly be impacted if we paid attention to those ports and in a binational way really address the enormous flow of chemicals that are coming through there, because that's really the Achilles heel of the trafficking world today.
We're talking to Sam Quinones right now, journalist and author of several books on the opioid epidemic and the drug trade, his latest, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. We're looking at drugs like fentanyl, how they're raising the risks after a federal commission's report yesterday on how to try to curb the trafficking of these synthetic opioid drugs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has drug use or maybe a drug overdose impacted your life or that of a loved one? What do you want to see done to try to prevent addictions and deaths stemming from these more potent drugs containing fentanyl. What questions do you have for our guest? And if you work in the field, in addiction treatment, say, or law enforcement, what are you seeing where you are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with journalist and author Sam Quiñones, whose books include The Least of Us, True Tales of America, and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. We're looking at the problems that synthetic drugs create and what can be done about it. You could join in with your questions, maybe your stories, at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Neenah. Rick, hi.
Hello. About 20 years ago, I lost my sister. She was a heroin addict. And died from that. And I've looked at all of the things that have happened to her and have happened since. And it occurs to me that our best bet is to not try to stop it, is just to legalize it and then put into place controls, right? And the controls in the United States would also translate the controls elsewhere, which would have a gigantic impact on the crime, not only here in the United States, but worldwide. It would allow us to have funding to go ahead and treat opiate addiction as a public health crisis rather than as a criminal activity.
Rick, thanks for the call. Sorry for the loss of your sister. Sam, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, we don't seem to be doing a very good job with marijuana. I go back and forth on this topic almost every day, maybe every hour, frankly. You know, we are dealing, though, with fentanyl here. The idea that people would make fentanyl legal for use, I just can't see how that would work. Honestly, it is too deadly. Now, heroin's another issue. On the other hand, I think I would like to see marijuana done well, and I don't think we're doing that well at all. You know, there's no attempt to put in strict controls on potency. There's no attempt to really inspect if it's a consumable, inspect it as a food or a consumable liquid would be inspected. If it's a medicine, inspect it the way a drug would be inspected. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we need. And until we do something right with a drug like marijuana, I doubt our capacity to do that on a level with something like heroin. I also think that I just doubt our ability as Americans to do it. Other countries might be able to do it in a better way, but it seems to me that we just have this laissez-faire idea that when it comes to drugs is really going to be dangerous. We have this natural tendency, it seems to me, in this country to get out of the way of large concentrations of power and money and influence. And we see this in big pharma, big oil, you name it, big this, big that. And I think we need to put in place controls that would prevent big pot, let alone big fentanyl someday, you know.
Rick, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Sam, something you cover in your book, The Least of Us, we have actually a frequent public health guest here on the show, Dr. Patrick Remington, who writes about diseases of despair, which includes suicides, alcohol-related deaths, and drug overdose and drug-related deaths. You are looking at not just, you know, this individual demand, but kind of as a social problem, creating despair and a demand for these drugs. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think one of the things that struck me without me actually looking for it, but just couldn't avoid it early on in my first book, Dreamland, on this topic, was the idea that at root here was what we as a culture, as a country, have kind of inflicted on ourselves, which is this kind of generalized shredding of what brings us together, generalized shredding of community in many, many ways, you know. Could be jobs going overseas and the community that's left behind is left to fend for itself. But it also could be, you know, municipal planning and a suburban development and all these different ways in which we have decided that the urge for community doesn't, we don't need to follow it, or old rules don't apply to us. When in fact, the idea behind community is one of the most powerful things, probably the most powerful idea that we evolved to prize, because it kept us alive. It allowed us to survive. It's this idea that we don't survive without others. And that's what allowed us as a species to survive. It's very clear to me. It's just that in the last 40 years in the United States, we seem to have decided that we don't need that kind of stuff. We don't want to pay taxes for it. We don't want to support it. If the jobs leave one community, well, that community is kind of on its own and deal with it, you know. And it just seems you could go on and on and on about the ways in which we have stripped and shredded the pillars and the bulwarks that keep us together as a community. And it was very difficult for me to avoid that conclusion as I was writing about first the opioid epidemic and now this synthetic drug era, which is the subject of the second book, The Least of Us. But the reason I called it the book The Least of Us, it's a book about synthetic drugs, but it's the heart and soul of the book is about people who understand the importance of community and in small ways are working in the smallest, least sexy ways are working to repair community, knowing that they are not saving the world in some noble, virtuous sense, knowing they're not necessarily going to be applauded or anything. It's just daily showing up to work at repairing and making their areas, their towns, their streets, whatever it happens to be, a better place. So my book is really about synthetic drugs, but the core of it, the heart and soul of it, is the idea that we possess within us as human beings, having evolved for the last millions of years, this essential nature, this is the most potent force more potent than drugs, it seems to me, except that in the United States, at least, we've decided that it's not that important and we could do without it.
I want to hear more about the hope side of your book, The Least of Us, Sam. Can you share an example of the kind of work you see people doing that is hopefully going to help rebuild that fabric and then help deal with problems like opioids?
Well, there are many stories, and it's not just dealing with opioids and addiction I wanted to focus on. I was really focused on something broader. And so I'll tell you the story of Bird, a guy named Bird in the south, a neighborhood in South Muncie, Indiana. It used to be a town that was devoted to producing transmission capital of America, two enormous plants right in that neighborhood where he lived. And those plants began to wither away, and the jobs left, and finally they closed. The city decides, you know what, we have to do something. We don't have any budget to keep us going. So they decide we're going to close the community centers in each of the neighborhoods where we have them. One of them is right across from the street from Bird's house where he's grown up. He's worked there at that community center. And so the city leaders close the community center, they think, except that Bird keeps the key. Right. And so what ends up happening as the jobs are finally gone and as the opioid epidemic begins to really take a toll, Bird becomes a community center unto himself. He daily opens it for the kids to play basketball and for the older folks to play cards. And when there's a wedding or when there's a birthday, he is the community center, keeping it alive when the city leaders really thought it was closed. They didn't really know that he was opening it. All the time. He certainly put no budget into it. He's the one fixing the toilets, the one mowing the lawns. And he, for several years that way, he keeps that neighborhood, gives that neighborhood a center through which it can weather some of the most stressful economic and drug-induced problems that they've ever had. It's that kind of story that I wanted to tell. Nobody has ever told Bird's story. I just kind of stumbled on it myself, and it was an exhilarating moment when I did. But the idea was not so much to deal with addiction per se, but to deal with the idea of how do we do things to keep ourselves in community and connected to one another, even when there doesn't seem to be any way to do it. I mean, the easiest thing for him to do is throw up his hands and say, oh, well, what are we going to do? Instead, he says, you know what? Folks need this. This is a way that we can weather some very tough times. Don't know how long it'll last. And he just goes ahead and every day opens that center for the kids and for the folks who need to use it.
And Sam, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure.
That's Sam Quiñones, journalist, author of books about the opioid epidemic, including Dreamland and his latest, The Least of Us. He joined us to talk about the rise of fentanyl in the drug market and a variety of solutions on the table. Find a link to a new report on the issue at WPR.org/centraltime. If you or someone you know is dealing with substance use or addiction, the Department of Health and Human Service National Helpline is 800-662-HELP. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time.